This is Dave Evans of HearThis.com speaking today with Dr. Maha Hussain, a professor with the Departments of Internal Medicine and Urology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Hussain is a medical oncologist who is an expert in genitourinary cancers. Her clinical interests include prostate and bladder cancer, and her research interests include the development of new therapies for prostate, bladder, and kidney cancer. Dr. Hussain earned her MD in 1980 and has served with the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor since 2002. Dr. Hussain, there seem to be several types of advanced stage prostate cancer. First diagnosis, failure after primary therapy, failure after secondary treatment, metastatic disease. Would you comment on the differences and how an individual can manage each stage?
Certainly. At first diagnosis, when a patient gets a diagnosis of prostate cancer, depending on what the pathology from the biopsies show and the PSA, generally they undergo an assessment for metastatic disease. Currently, we consider prostate cancer advanced not just if there is metastatic disease in the bones, but certainly if they have pelvic lymph nodes involved or if they have a very large disease in the prostate. All of these are potentially considered advanced prostate cancer. Any disease that has not gone outside the pelvis is generally managed with combination treatments, so as patients should be assessed by a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, and a medical oncologist. Patients who receive radiation or surgery for their primary disease can actually manifest a failure of their disease with a PSA that goes up after surgery or radiation. The kinetics of the PSA after local treatment have to be looked at differently based on whether a person had surgery or radiation treatment. And so that in these situations, again, a staging to assess whether there's visible metastatic disease or not is necessary. And then based on the presence or absence of metastatic disease, recommendations can be made. Certainly, this is an area where salvage radiation can be done if the patient has had a radical prostatectomy as their primary treatment. Rarely, though, the opposite is true in that patients who fail radiation most of the time are not candidates for salvage prostatectomy, though that can be considered in highly selected cases. Patients who are not candidate for a salvage local therapy or fail multiple local treatments, say surgery and radiation, should be considered for either experimental treatment or hormonal therapy or observation, depending on their PSA kinetics. Once patients have been on hormones and failed hormonal treatment, say for a rising PSA, again, a restaging assessment becomes important to determine if there is visible metastatic disease or not. And then according to that, recommendations can be made, but certainly at that point, for sure, they should be seeing a medical oncologist. Luckily, these days, few patients have metastatic disease at diagnosis into the bone or the lymph nodes outside the pelvis, which are the more common sites of metastatic disease. The standard treatment for them is hormone treatment. This is a population that we clearly encourage to be considered for clinical trials that are looking at novel treatment approaches.
You touched on hormone therapy and some of the treatment options. What are the recommended treatment options for recurring prostate cancer? And also, how does hormone therapy figure into this?
So again, the recurrence is going to have to be qualified or characterized a bit better. Is this recurrence that's just biochemical, or this is a recurrence that is associated with visible metastatic disease? The simpler answer is for those who have clearly visible metastatic disease, then hormone treatment, usually an LHRH agonist or an injection, a hormonal treatment is the indicated therapy with or without the use of an oral agent, as we label them as anti-androgens, drugs like Casodex or flutamide. Generally, Casodex is really what is the most widely used anti-androgen. Orchiectomy, removal of the testis, is certainly an option. However, I'd say in my current practice over the last 10 years, and certainly since the introduction of long-term depot formulation of LHRH agonists, pretty much every man does not wish to receive an orchiectomy. And clearly using the injectable medications allow you to even approach the hormonal therapy with an intermittent approach. The more difficult question, Dave, is what to do with a person who has a biochemical failure. So that's a person who had surgery or radiation, and the only manifestation of their relapse is a PSA failure. That's a difficult group of patients because not all of these patients will actually have a bad disease, and most likely the majority will not die from prostate cancer. And so tailoring the hormone therapy in this population has to take into account the age of the patients, the rapidity with which the PSA goes up, what was the status of their disease, what are their wishes, can they deal with the comorbidities of hormonal treatment or not, and so on. In my practice, practice, I'd say probably about half of the men would, in fact, I would consider good candidates for sort of salvage hormonal therapy. And the other half I tend to watch. And the ones I tend to watch tend to be the older men who have very slow doubling time.
I've heard that hormone therapy can have an effect on bones, cholesterol levels, et cetera. I mean, you make some great points when you talk about the number of factors outside of the direct treatment that need to be considered. You know, for example, effect on lifestyle, what are the patient's wishes, you know, and so on. What should my doctor be doing to ensure minimizing side effects? Or in the same sense, what should I be doing as a patient to minimize the side effects from hormone therapy?
What I tell my patients generally is what's good for your heart is good for your cancer. And so most of the patients who go on hormonal treatment, because of the alteration in their testosterone levels, their agility, their physical stamina may change. And so men tend to be less active. There may be some psychological elements, some body image elements, and so on. So they can tend to gain weight because, again, their metabolic rate goes down as testosterone is suppressed. Because of the lack of testosterone, the bones may lose their density, and so they potentially are at risk of fracture. Those who gain weight and who may be predisposed to diabetes, they may become, frankly, diabetic. Certainly cholesterol can go up and so on. So I think the key thing to counteract the side effects is to maintain high level of activity and mobility. That's clearly important. Exercise, watching your diet. We all get older, and as we get older, even without hormone treatment, generally our exercise tolerance kind of goes down and our metabolic rate goes down. And so it's important to maintain a healthy exercise. Generally, we advise that men who are going to be on long-term hormones is to have a bone density, which is a simple X-ray that can be done to the bones, looking at whether the bones are thinning or not. This can be done by their primary care physician periodically or their oncologist or urologist. Generally, I advise my patients to go on vitamin D and calcium supplementation once they're on hormonal treatment. As far as the cholesterol and blood sugar and so on, we generally screen for that in our clinics, and certainly that's something that the patient needs to be aware of. There's been recently some kind of scary information about heart attacks and so on. I want to reassure patients that this whole issue of cardiovascular negative effects have never been shown to outweigh the potential benefits from using hormonal treatment. So the point here is if your doctor says you should be on treatment, do not avoid it for fear of cardiovascular effects or bone effects. Certainly your doctor is able to monitor things with you, and together with him, one can maintain a low level of side effects. Now, there are other side effects that are not necessarily sort of directly damaging to health, but certainly are a nuisance, and these are the issue of hot flashes. And I'd say probably about 6 in 10 men will get some form of hot flashes, rarely severe, but certainly that can be quite disturbing, and especially if it happens at night. There are, again, proper medications that can be given based on the severity of the hot flashes and the bother index for the patients. Different centers now have actually specialized survivorship clinics that we have, that we offer to our prostate cancer patients, not just to deal with general coping issues, but rather physical effects of treatment, whether surgery or radiation or hormones, such as issues of sexuality and the ability to try to maintain some form of effective erection and so on.
With regard to hormonal therapy, there is a, you know, what we would call a clock involved, right? A certain amount of time before it no longer works. Given that, does it make sense to utilize hormonal therapy intermittently? And if so, who are the best candidates?
So the answer is yes, but one has to make it clear that intermittent hormone therapy as an approach is considered experimental. We have been testing it in metastatic prostate cancer in an international trial, which is hopefully to complete its full accrual of close to 3,000 patients this year. There have been other trials from Europe that are, again, large trials that have looked at different stages of prostate cancer using intermittent therapy. The general principles are it's an approach that is useful if the patient is in need of long-term hormone treatment. So a patient who is getting, say, hormone therapy adjuvantly in conjunction, say, with radiation really would not be the ideal patient to put onto intermittent therapy. So anytime you're giving hormones with the intent of, quote-unquote, cure, then it ought to be given in long, protracted durations of time. It's when you're intending to give it palliatively, then I think intermittent therapy could be one alternative, particularly if you're expecting the patient to be on long-term treatment for, say, advanced disease and they're having side effects and so on. Clearly, counseling them on the fact that this is experimental, though early data would suggest it is safe, is important. Again, patients clearly with metastatic disease are patients who could be considered for intermittent therapy.
So if I'm a hormonal therapy patient, how do I know if it's beginning to fail? Does PSA monitoring help determine an action point in this regard?
The answer is absolutely yes, because I will tell you in practically 100% of times, and maybe we shouldn't say 100, but 95% of times, you as a patient will not feel anything different. Most of the patients we pick who have failed hormonal therapy are generally men who have a rising PSA. What I advise is that no one should lose sleep over one value, because clearly there is room for errors in variations in readings and such. So what's more important is really a trend that there is a steady gradual increase. Those who are on hormonal treatment, we generally advise that a testosterone level is done to assure that indeed the injections are doing their job, that the testosterone is suppressed in what we consider medically appropriate range, which is the castration range testosterone. There are some men who are treated with oral hormonal agents, specifically the use of antiandrogens and 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, so something like Proscar, Casodex. These are the kind of men that I think once their PSA go up, clearly their testosterone level will not help because their testosterones generally are normal or high normal. These are the patients that I think should go for what we consider gonadal suppressive agents. So this is the LHRH agonist or antagonist type agents to assure that the reason that the PSA is going up is really not because the cancer is getting out of control. But definitely I'd say PSA, and I would go with more than one value before assuming that the cancer is progressing.
Is there anything that can be done with supplements, diet, lifestyle that can prevent the cancer from progressing without using hormone therapy or chemotherapy?
So to be honest with you, I am yet to see any hard, reproducible, credible data that says going on supplements somehow when you have advanced disease can help as far as preventing your cancer from progressing. So the answer would be, in my opinion, no. And there are multiple reports, and we've looked at different dietary supplements and such, and the answer is really nothing that will stand scrutiny of peer review, and certainly no randomized phase 3 trial. So having said that, remember what I said, what's good for your heart is good for your cancer. So really, your lifestyle should tailor towards a healthy lifestyle. I generally advise moderation in everything. I don't think you have to stop red meat. I don't think you have to stop eating sugars whatsoever or carbohydrates or so on. Everything in moderation is a good thing. Now, there are several natural things that, you know what, they taste good, they are not harmful, and you can do them. So instead of taking supplements of soy, you could actually eat the soybean. It gives you the fiber, it gives you the vitamins, and it gives you the fresh vegetable. Things like, you know, pomegranate juice is quite popular now with people. I personally take it because I enjoy drinking it, and I can't think of it as being harmful. But I really want to stress that there's really no data that says taking these agents in any kind of testing format have been shown to unequivocally delay progression from prostate cancer, specifically while patients are taking hormone therapy or on chemotherapy.
Are there certain PSA levels or conditions, regardless of the stage of disease, when action should be taken? For example, looking at the PSA velocity and doubling time.
It all depends, David, on the setting. So a patient who has clearly metastatic disease, the PSA doubling time and velocity, in my opinion, is not the driving force. It's the presence of metastatic disease is what determines treatment. In situations where patients have, say, only PSA failure after local treatment, then I think in those situations the answer is yes. So we know that patients who have very slow doubling time, so very slow rate of rise, are the kinds of patients that are probably not likely to suffer from problems from prostate cancer for decades and potentially may die from natural causes and certainly not prostate cancer-related causes. Whereas patients with PSA is doubling every 3 months or less, we know that these are the men who are likely to suffer a visible recurrence of disease within a short period of time. And so one has to tailor all of that and then think very carefully about what's the objective of therapy. So if you have an older gentleman who has absolutely no symptoms, who has other comorbidities, treating them at the point of a PSA doubling that's short, let's say 6 months, when they in fact have congestive heart failure and COPD and so on, treatment then is likely to cause more problems and is not likely to prolong life. Whereas a person who is asymptomatic from cancer and younger and has very rapid doubling time, this is the kind of person that I would seriously encourage to be considered for clinical trials and very carefully counseled on standard and experimental options, such as if they had radical prostatectomy, then you know you could consider salvage radiation, and if they progress after that, then consideration for hormonal treatment, different forms of hormonal treatment or clinical trials would be appropriate.
How does a patient know when he should move from a urologist or radiation oncologist to a medical oncologist as the primary physician managing his disease?
What I tell patients, and I'm kind of in a bit of a fortunate circumstance in that we have a very multidisciplinary team. And so anytime you have slightly higher risk disease, so a disease that does not have a high chance of being cured with surgery or radiation, the urologist and the radiation oncologist will get the medical oncologist involved very early in the course of the disease. So I'm going to give you my bias, and that bias may not be practical in every setting, but any time you have a cancer that has a high Gleason score or a cancer that is large in your prostate that is, say, causing you symptoms, or the urologist examines you and says, you know what, your prostate is quite large, I think the cancer might have gone outside the capsule of the prostate, or a PSA that's high, you know, maybe above 15 or so, especially if the Gleason score is high, this is the kind of situations where I think that consultation with a medical oncologist is not a bad idea, particularly because not that the medical oncologist will be treating the patients, but these are the populations that we are looking at for national trials that are targeting systemic therapy plus local therapy to try to increase the cure rate from local treatment. And so there are multiple national trials, and a patient will not have the access to them if they're not seen by medical oncologist or if they don't question their urologist or radiation oncologist. So I encourage them to say, do I have other options? Is there an experimental protocol I can be in? What is their out? And that doesn't mean you have to be part of the trial, but at least you will be informed. Certainly, once a patient fails local treatment, surgery or radiation, or surgery followed by radiation, I certainly would suggest that the patient be consulted with a medical oncologist at that time. For sure, if the patient has disease that has progressed on hormones, in the absence of metastatic disease, and if the patient has metastatic disease, I personally think the patient should be in the hand of the medical oncologist.
It sounds like a combination, number one, of what fits best with your lifestyle, what makes you the happiest, what are the issues, what are the things that are facing you, what is it that you want to get from treatment and from your life and your lifestyle and that sort of thing. That's one of the important issues. Another one is this idea of healthy, balanced living certainly is something that we could all probably do better in. What you've just talked about sounds a lot to me like I should really be exploring information with my doctor, spending time with my doctor, talking about this rather than worrying about it. The information really comes out as a result of participation.
I think it's important for patients to be proactive. And there are, I'm sure, part of your group and certainly available on the internet, there are multiple very credible sources of information that gives the patients updates on what's happening nationally, what's happening in terms of clinical trials, what is the more current thinking. It doesn't mean you are really violating or deviating from what your doctor is informing you. Really, what you're doing is your part to verify that indeed you have satisfied all your curiosity about and information need about what you need to know before you actually make a decision.
When should a patient consider entering into a clinical trial? And how does he know what's best for him?
Well, so I think that, believe it or not, in every state of the disease, there is at least one, if not more than one, clinical trial available that are either larger trials as part of comparing different treatments for the specific state of disease or institutional trials that are generally available with either your urologist or if you see a medical oncologist or a radiation oncologist. And certainly you could inquire from specialized centers. Essentially, every state has a comprehensive cancer center in it, if not two. And so inquire and see what's available to you. The clinicaltrials.gov, which is a website that the government has that now has essentially all clinical trials that are done in this country listed in it. These are some sources that are available nationally to the patients with access to internet, contacting the American Cancer Society and so on. And of course, absolutely speak with your own doctor. If the doctor says, well, I really don't know what is available, then ask him to refer you to somebody who knows, or you do your homework to try to find out what's available. As I said, there is a clinical trial for every state of disease practically everywhere in this country. Whether a patient is eligible or not is something that can be done via a simple screening, sometimes by phone. And if you are in a region where there is a comprehensive center that has highly specialized expertise in prostate cancer, a consultation with a person there would be appropriate. Just remember, research is what cures cancer. Doing nothing about it does not cure cancer.
What great advice to end on. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we conclude?
Just a positive note that prostate cancer is a serious disease, but by any standard, it is not as fatal as some other cancers. Having said that, we can always do better in terms of increasing cure rates. But the good news is that mortality from the disease is going down, and there are multiple, I would say, better, not yet ideal, but better options for patients who have advanced disease. And if anything, right now, for the majority of patients that we have who are newly diagnosed with this disease, really the focus is on how to minimize the morbidity of therapy, because we do have curative treatments, and the majority of patients that are diagnosed with prostate cancer nowadays will not die from prostate cancer. And so these are good news. The question is, how do we go to the next step where we not only increase the cure rates even further, but minimize the morbidity of men who are destined to live multiple decades after their diagnosis?
What a positive note. We've been speaking today with Dr. Maha Hussain about advanced stage prostate cancer and the issues, challenges, and practical options available. On behalf of everyone at ProstateNet, thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today. Thanks as well to our listeners for taking the time to learn more about prostate health and the difference that they can make in their own life for the benefit of themselves, their friends, and family, and the community to which they belong. This podcast is a copyrighted production of ProstateNet and HearThis.com. All rights are reserved.